Whammy Radio continues.
One of the reasons I began watching the Clippers had more to do with then-Commissioner David Stern's vetoing of the original Laker trade than the official Clipper trade itself. Once the Clippers trade took place, I kept a close eye on this team, for I predicted Chris Paul's arrival was more than just a culture change. It was a change of an era. Pessimism was out, pride was in, and a winning culture was established in Clipper Nation. We have here Steve Perrin, blog founder and blog editor of Clips Nation, representing the SB Nation community. Welcome to Whammy Radio.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We're going to pick the Clippers' brains and study their mentality, their ego. How ready is the red, white, and blue? Are you up to it?
Let's give it a shot.
And we must start with Donald Sterling. Everything that was bad about the Clippers started and ended with him. Racism, sexism, slumlordism, cheapskatism, ineptitudism. And 40 years later, Sterling has become Dr. Jerry Buss. My theory on Sterling's change of heart had something to do with Oakland Raiders owner Al Davis, who was practically his only mentor when he didn't know anything about owning a sports team. When Davis passed away in October of 2011 during the NBA lockout, Sterling had a man-in-the-mirror moment and realized he had to win and change his ways before it was too late. After the lockout was lifted, magical things started to happen. What do you believe changed Donald Sterling?
Well, I think there's a school of thought that says that Sterling changed gradually over time. He always maintained that he would pay superstar money for superstar players and said, hey, I just haven't had the players. That was always his position. Certainly, when you look at guys like Michael Olowokandi and Maurice Taylor, guys that have been lottery picks for the Clippers that just weren't good lottery picks. The Clippers were, in retrospect, absolutely correct not to pay them big contracts when they became free agents. So Sterling would say, I was always willing to pay to have a winner. I just didn't have the players to do it. And I think there's a little bit of truth in that. I think more importantly, there were individuals along the way that have gotten his ear and have convinced him again. I think it's more gradual than it might appear otherwise, that have convinced him that he needs to allow the basketball people to make basketball decisions. I think a guy like Mike Dunleavy doesn't get enough credit for his role in changing the Clippers over time. 2006, they made the playoffs. That was a Dunleavy team.
Sam Cassell. Elton Brand.
Getty, a really good team. And frankly, they were positioned to be, I mean, I think it's interesting that we're looking at this supposed sea change in Los Angeles of Lakers Clippers. We actually thought that was happening in 2006. Kobe was asking for a trade. The Clippers were young and talented, and they had just some terrible Clipper-esque bad luck between Elton Brand's Achilles and Sean Livingston's gruesome injury, et cetera. But let's get back up to the present. I think Dunleavy did have an effect on the overall. So it's been a gradual thing. Donald Sterling is a bad guy. He's not a nice man. He's been incredibly successful as a real estate developer. His mentality has always been buy and hold. So people who wanted him to sell the Clippers just didn't understand that that's just not in his nature. He's always going to sit there and hang on to his assets and watch them appreciate over time. That's been what he's done in the real estate market. That's what he's going to do with the Clippers. But he has, over time, come to understand that he needs to get good basketball people into his organization and allow those people to make decisions. Mike Dunleavy brought in Neil O'Shea. Neil O'Shea was allowed to make some decisions. After O'Shea, they had groomed Gary Sachs. And the real key here is paying an NBA season high this season for the salary of Doc Rivers. The Clippers have the highest paid coach in the NBA. And that, more than anything else, says what you need to know about Donald Sterling's transformation. There's no salary cap on coaches. There's no salary minimum on coaches. You pay them what you think they're worth. And Mark Cuban could pay anything he wants for an NBA coach. The Clippers have the highest paid coach in the NBA. And that was just simply unthinkable even 5 years ago. It just simply would not have happened but Sterling is at this point committed to winning. It's been a gradual transformation. And I think your point about Al Davis is well taken as well. I think that Sterling likes winning better than he likes losing. Surprise, surprise. And he's come to realize that he's simply going to have to spend some money and put the right people in place in order to win.
Was the passing of Dr. Buss also an influence into Sterling's transformation? Remember that Donald Sterling and Jerry Buss were friends. Sterling helped Dr. Buss in purchasing the Lakers from Jack Kent Cooke with a $2.7 million loan. My take on this was that because Sterling helped the Lakers, he unintentionally cursed the Clippers. Elaborate on Sterling's relationship with Dr. Buss, how Jerry convinced Donald to join the NBA, and when the Lakers were being relocated to Staples Center in Los Angeles, why Buss wanted the Clippers to come along with him.
Well, as you alluded to, the two owners have, you know, a long history. They both made a lot of money in Los Angeles real estate. When Sterling was an NBA owner, he convinced Jerry Buss that it was a smart thing to do. And for those many, many, many decades, they were very opposite owners, where Jerry Buss had very talented, very well-paid people in his organization that he allowed to make the decisions. And he basically was saying, he was asking good questions, he was being involved, but at the end of the day, he was saying, if you think that's the right thing to do, then we'll spend the money on that. And yeah, the Lakers absolutely put the Clippers into a massive shadow for all that time. With Dr. Buss passing away, is Donald Sterling looking at it saying, gosh, I don't have that much more time to make an impact with this team, to I have an opportunity here. You know, is he thinking about his own mortality a little bit? You know, possibly. Let's face facts. Donald Sterling has never had one player the caliber of Blake Griffin or Chris Paul, let alone two at the same time. So he does have an opportunity. He realizes that he's always been a good businessman. And I think that he realizes that those two players are an opportunity for him. That's good business. He has to keep them happy and he has to keep them around. And that's why they're signed to long-term contracts. And that's a big part of why the Clippers are doing well, for sure.
DeAndre Jordan is an athletic shot-blocking freak. He can change shots, block shots, dunk shots, unlike any other big man in the NBA. But when he played under bad coach Vinny Del Negro, he was always looking behind his back. He was never comfortable under him. He was always pulled in fourth quarters by him, using poor free throw shooting as a cop-out. Everything Vinny did to save his own skin damaged DeAndre's confidence. Much so, Vinny was ready to trade him for Kevin Garnett and Dwight Howard. How did Doc Rivers save DJ from Vinny and from himself?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. Intentionally or unintentionally, everything that Vinny did just tore down DeAndre's confidence over time. Doc has taken the polar opposite approach from the very first press conference as head coach of the Clippers. Doc Rivers was talking about how great he thought DeAndre Jordan was. He in his opening remarks, he said he thought he had defensive player of the year potential. He said that he was going to be part of their big three. And at the time, I don't think anybody believed him. I thought, you know, I think they thought this is just coach speak. This is just him trying to get as much as possible out of DeAndre Jordan. But nobody thought that Jordan could be as good as Doc Rivers was saying. So Doc has got to get a huge amount of credit for seeing that potential, for nurturing that potential, and for creating the confidence in DeAndre Jordan to come out and achieve his potential. Leading the league in rebounding, I mean, that's just, we just never would have seen that coming. He was a good rebounder, but he wasn't a great rebounder. He wasn't focused enough to be a great rebounder. He didn't care enough to go out and get rebounds, to be that rebounder. And it's been an absolutely amazing transformation. The main part is that Doc has gotten DeAndre to accept who he is in the NBA. I've long said that DeAndre Jordan should be and could be a Tyson Chandler type of player, a guy that doesn't care a bit about offense, but goes out and has a massive impact on the defensive end. And Doc Rivers has really gotten DeAndre to see that, to embrace that. He really cares about being a great defender, a great rebounder. He doesn't pout when he doesn't get touches. And oh, by the way, he's going to get plenty of putbacks and dunks and lob passes. And you know, he's going to get opportunities to score as well, even if he's not getting post-ups called for him. So I think you really had the answer from the start. Vinny Del Negro tore down DeAndre Jordan's confidence. Doc Rivers has built it up, and we see the difference.
Blake Griffin is the most scrutinized player in the league today. He makes commercials. He's personable. He's a humanitarian. He flops. He whines. He complains. He rigs games to steal wins. Other players and teams hate Griffin for all those good things. They've taken it personally and made it a mission to destroy Griffin's image or force him into doing something that he would later regret. Why do they hate Blake Griffin so much?
It's a good question. I think anybody that's played basketball at any level knows that there are certain players that get under your skin, that just sort of annoy you, and you may not even be able to put your finger on it all the time. I think Blake is one of those guys. He goes hard all the time. He is not an angel. I think that a lot of people who are Clippers fans would defend him to the death and say, oh, he's the nicest guy out there. I don't know why everybody picks on him. You know, he's out there giving guys shoves, giving guys little elbows when the ref's head is turned. He's very physical. He's always leaning on guys. He's always pushing guys. He's always looking for that little extra advantage, like most smart players do. So, yeah, he's getting under guys' skin for sure. Where there's smoke, there's fire. And if so many other opponents have such a problem with him, he's doing something to deserve it. And if you look, you know, he's doing that chicken wing thing where he's locking up guys' arms. He is giving extra little shoves. It's subtle stuff. It's smart stuff from a basketball standpoint. But he's getting under people's skin for sure. Now, you add in the fact that he is a 25-year-old who is one of the most endorsed players in the NBA, one of the most overexposed players in the NBA in some ways. He's out there dunking on people. He's out there trying to embarrass you, maybe not actively trying to embarrass you, but that's what he does. He dunks on people. He puts them on their posters. And that's another thing that his opponents are not gonna like. Veterans in particular really seem to have an issue with Blake. And I think that all of what we've said just is exasperated when you're talking about a guy that's been in the league for, you know, 10 years and doesn't have that type of exposure, to have this guy who's so young and so talented coming in and, you know, really maybe embarrassing you a little bit, that's going to really get under your skin also. So I think it's a combination of things. Blake is not, you know, completely innocent in all of this, but it is what it is. And superstars always excite strong emotions on both sides. It's not like LeBron James is loved by everyone. There's plenty of people that had significant issues with LeBron over the years as well. It's just a measure of how good he is to some extent that he does excite so much emotion on both sides.
I saw Spurs Thunder game that featured a double technical between Kendrick Perkins and Tim Duncan. Perkins was steaming as a stove, and Duncan just walked away, smiling all the while. I think this is what Blake Griffin is trying to add into his game, how to maintain composure and restrict his actions to what is allowed on the basketball court. But a lot of sports critics want him to be an instigator, an enforcer, somebody like Charles Barkley or Ron Artest. How much do you think Blake Griffin is trying to become Tim Duncan so that his opponents are the ones who get caught in the act?
Well, my personal feeling on the sort of Charles Barkley school of thought that says that Blake Griffin needs to turn around and punch somebody in the nose at some point, that's just not true. It's fairly silly position to take, in my opinion. It's, you know, if other people are trying to get Griffin to react and get him kicked out, well, that's exactly what he shouldn't do. He shouldn't react. He shouldn't get himself suspended by throwing a punch. And the idea that teams are taking advantage of the quote unquote soft Clippers because Griffin won't react, you know, that's always been overblown. the NBA punditry tends to overreact to a playoff loss. And, you know, last season they lost to the Memphis Grizzlies, and the narrative became that the Clippers were too soft.
And Chris Paul got ejected for the first time in his career, which led to a possible rumor that he could leave to the Knicks.
Right. And, you know, it was all just completely overblown. It didn't make any sense at the time, and it doesn't make any sense now. Griffin does absolutely need to emulate more of a Tim Duncan type of presence that says, I'm not going to be pulled into your games. I'm not going to do that. I am tough because I am tough, but I'm not tough because I'm going to throw a punch. That's not what I do. And I think that he's done a very good job of that. And back to Doc Rivers, he has absolutely supported and praised Griffin for his demeanor on the court this season. And I think that he's done an excellent job. He got tossed out of the game against the Golden State Warriors, but later the NBA agreed that it was a mistake, that they shouldn't have, that he had been that he had behaved appropriately and shouldn't have gotten technical fouls in the situation that he did. And, you know, it's unfortunate that the NBA made that mistake, but Griffin has handled all of this scrutiny and all of these flagrant fouls the way that he needs to, in my opinion. He should not turn around and punch anybody. Anybody that says he's not tough just isn't paying attention. The dude is tough as nails. You don't have to punch a guy to know that he is tough.
You can just dunk on people. That proves you're tough.
Seems to me that does a pretty good job of making the point.
December 25th, 2013, Clippers versus Warriors. Griffin gets involved in two scuffles with Draymond Green and Andrew Bogut. Both featured flagrant fouls, but in both situations, Griffin got techs. For the second time in his career, he was ejected, but it was the first in a game with more than 5 minutes remaining. The minute I saw the ejection on ESPN, I said to myself, this was the end of Blake Griffin. He was going to be traded. After the Trailblazers game, there were trade talks of Griffin for Carmelo Anthony. Clippers believed he couldn't do it anymore. They didn't want a title. They wanted revenge against the Dubs for what they did to Griffin. Then, the most miraculous thing happened. Griffin heard of the rumor, took it to heart, and vowed he would never get involved in those scuffles ever again. He improved his game religiously. He started scoring more. He started assisting more. He started taking the leadership role more. And when Chris Paul went out with a shoulder injury, it became the perfect opportunity for Griffin to prove his worth. Was the unjust ejection a blessing in disguise? Did the ejection of Blake Griffin turn him into a superstar?
I'm gonna say no. I'm gonna disagree with you on that. I think that it was, you know, as we said, the NBA came back and said that it was a mistake. The reason it was a mistake, pretty clearly to me anyway, is that you can't, as an organization, the NBA cannot allow a tactic as transparent as the Warriors were employing there. You can't allow it to work. Blake Griffin took two separate flagrant fouls off the ball. These are off the ball flagrant fouls within about 3 minutes of game time. You're telling me that's not part of a tactic to try to get him ejected? It seemed pretty transparent to me, and the NBA allowed it to work, and they can't do that. They can't allow it to work. Griffin's reactions in each case, I thought, were not inappropriate. You can't tell these guys to be robots. You can't tell them to do nothing. So if somebody's got you locked up and you push them away, that's a reasonable response and shouldn't get a technical foul. So I'm not really going to jump on with your theory there. Sorry about that. But, you know, the Carmelo Anthony rumors were always self-serving for the New York-based media. It never really made any sense for the Clippers. I don't think anybody in Los Angeles ever took them seriously at all. I think overall, Blake's transformation this season has been a continuum, not a specific, this is the point where he became that player. Certainly in the absence of Chris Paul, we saw that he could do it on his own. And I think that was always part of the mythology of Griffin is overrated, was oh, he couldn't do this if he didn't have Chris Paul as a teammate. Now, my point on that all along has been, go back and look at his rookie year numbers. When he didn't have Chris Paul as a teammate, he was incredibly productive without Chris Paul. It was on a much worse team, certainly, but he was productive. So the idea that he only gets his numbers because he's feeding off of the best point guard in the NBA was never true. But Blake certainly stepped up in Paul's absence. He took a leadership role. He absolutely has become more of a playmaker, which is something that Doc Rivers wanted from the moment he walked in the door, was to get the ball into Griffin's hands more and to allow him to make more plays. That's with or without Chris Paul on the floor. Doc has wanted that. When Chris went down with that injury, it just accelerated that process. So I think it's been a gradual improvement for Blake. And yes, he is having his best season and is playing at a level that we haven't seen before from him. But I don't think there's any one thing that I would point to and say that's the moment. I think it's just been a logical progression for him.
The San Antonio Spurs, Golden State Warriors, Memphis Grizzlies share a single trait in that they all pose a mental edge against the Clippers. Spurs are invincibly good. Greg Popovich knows all the Clippers' moves before and after they make them. Chris Paul is 14-27 against San Antonio all time. The Grizzlies have Zach Randolph and Marc Gasol, who caused physical nightmares in the paint for Griffin and Jordan. Not only did they upset them in the first round last season, they got CP3 ejected for the first time in his career. The Warriors are a product of the Clippers' own doing. In the 2012-13 season, they underestimated Golden State as a lottery team, thinking they could easily defeat them, but they were totally wrong. Their negligence single-handedly turned Golden State into a playoff contender, with the mindset that they could sweep the Clippers in the playoffs. Even though the Dubs haven't been playing well as of late, they believe that if they beat the Clippers, everything will be dandy for Golden State. Knowing all this, do you think the Clippers have what it takes to make it in the playoffs? Is the greatest enemy for the Clippers their own worst fears? Do they possess the mental fortitude necessary to right their wrongs and vanquish all of their personal demons against these specific teams?
It's a valid question, and I think that there are, I think that there's certainly a school of thought out there that says that that the Clippers will struggle against some of those teams. We'll ignore the Spurs for a moment because they simply are the best team in the NBA right now. So, whether they have any particular edge over the Clippers is irrelevant. They have an edge over everybody right now because they're that good.
And the fact that they play like the 1920 original Celtics, because what they're doing is they're paying homage to the grandfathers of basketball. So let's get that straight.
They are awfully, awfully good. The Grizzlies, I don't think the Clippers want to see the Grizzlies in the first round. It's certainly a possibility at a 2-7 type of matchup if the Clippers can chase down the Thunder. However, I don't think that it's a question of the Clippers not being able to beat them. Part of the answer to your question is this is where Doc Rivers comes in. This is where the new coach, the highest paid coach in the NBA, the veteran coach who's been there and won the championship, this is where he will earn his money, is preparing them for a particular opponent, making sure that their mindset is correct against that opponent. The loss to the Grizzlies, in my opinion, is somewhat overblown. The Clippers had, in fact, it wasn't that the Clippers couldn't beat the Grizzlies going into those four straight games. The Clippers had, in fact, won a majority of the recent meetings between the two teams, including winning the season series and winning the playoff series the season before.
Let me interject a real minute. Had they won the third game at Memphis, it would have been an automatic sweep because no team has ever come back from a 0-3 in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, the Clippers were up 2-0 and they were playing well, and all that had really happened through four games was that each team had held their home court. The Clippers had won two in L.A. and the Grizzlies had won two in Memphis, and that's not particularly unusual. And then Blake Griffin turned his ankle and was a non-factor in the last two games. So in retrospect, I never really looked at that series and said, oh, wow, that really shows that the Grizzlies have the Clippers' numbers, not any more than the Grizzlies' 4-1 defeat of Oklahoma City in the next round showed that the Grizzlies had Oklahoma City's number, you know, because Westbrook was missing from that. So I never quite understood why no one seemed to give the Clippers the same pass on Griffin's injury that everyone gave Oklahoma City on Westbrook's injury. Now, having said that, the Clippers don't want to see the Grizzlies in the first round for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. Those guys have met 2 years in a row. They know it's going to be physical. They know it's going to be rough. And they know that the Grizzlies have some confidence against them. But another thing is, that is a very physical team. And the Clippers, even if they were to win that first round series, would likely take a beating. They're going to come out of that battered and bruised because the Grizzlies play that way. They're going to lean on you. Tony Allen is going to be all over Chris Paul for however many games that series lasts. It's going to be physically demanding. Zach Randolph is going to have all of his weight on Blake Griffin all the time, and it's just going to take a toll. So I don't think the Clippers want to see the Grizzlies, even if they feel like they can beat them, which I think they certainly would.
And they must, if they want to redeem themselves from last season.
Right. So I think that they don't want to see them for a very specific reason of physicality. The Warriors are an interesting case also, and I think you make a great point that early in the season, in the 12-13 season, the Clippers weren't taking them seriously, and the Warriors got a lot of confidence in games against the Clippers. The Warriors are a very interesting team in that if they get hot, and by they, you know, I'm really talking about Steph Curry and Klay Thompson.
Andre Iguodala?
Well, Iggy's going to do what he does. I think Iggy's less of a wild card. He's a great player. He's very important to that team. But he's not going to come out and make ridiculous shots. There are times when Steph Curry just is in a place where he is indefensible. He will come down and pull up off of the dribble and shoot long threes early in the shot clock, and they go in. And there's just really no defense for that. If a guy wants to take a transition three, if he's got that quick a trigger and that clean of a release, that's a shot that you really can't defend. And if Curry's making it, I don't know what you do. I don't know how you stop him. And he's had some incredible games against the Clippers over the last two seasons. So I think that they're an interesting team in that regard. They obviously, you know, do not like the Clippers. They relish the idea of going in there and throwing some extra elbows, whether it's David Lee or Draymond Green or Andrew Bogut.
Jermaine O'Neal, too. They have their own Chauncey Billups, so to speak.
Yeah, they've got O'Neal, who's really surprised me this season in the way that he's played. So it's a matchup that, you know, that the Clippers would, it will not be easy for them. And it may come down to how Steph Curry is shooting. There may not be any defense for them. Clippers are a better team. There's no question in my mind. You know, they've got the better record over the course of the season by quite a margin. They're a much better offensive team in terms of balance. They have more weapons that they can go to. But the Warriors are, they have a ton of confidence in the Clippers, and they are a very frightening matchup for the Clippers because of their ability to get red hot.
Let's go back to the Spurs. My reasoning for the Clippers not being able to defeat the Spurs has to do with Greg Popovich having Tony Parker and the fact that Chris Paul, to me anyway, is a clone of Tony Parker. Because Pop has analyzed Parker's strengths and weaknesses to a T, he could use that knowledge as a weapon against CP3. In my opinion, it has to be Blake Griffin who defeats the Spurs. Will the Clippers have to face the Spurs?
Well, obviously the Clippers hope that they will face the Spurs in the Western Conference Finals. The Spurs are essentially a lock at this point for the first overall seed. And the Clippers, if they were to meet the Spurs in the playoffs, it would be in the Western Conference Finals. So they hope they make it that far. I guess they could hope that the Spurs don't make it that far and they end up playing somebody else, but I don't think that's a very realistic situation. I think that one thing that I said about the matchup with the Grizzlies applies here also, which is that Doc Rivers is the coach of the Clippers now. And the last two seasons in the playoffs, it was a guy named Benny Del Negro.
Bad coach.
And so you hire Doc Rivers not for the regular season. you hire Doc Rivers for the playoffs. And so where he will earn that paycheck is if he can match wits with Popovich and come out okay. The Spurs are, they're just incredibly good. And every year we think, well, they can't be that good again this year because they're getting older. Tim Duncan what is he, 36, 37? I mean, but he just keeps getting better. And it's true of that entire team. Kawhi Leonard is an incredible player that they managed to get in the middle of the first round, and he's becoming a superstar in his own right. And it doesn't seem to matter who they put out there. They've turned Marco Bellinelli and Patty Mills into terrific players off the bench as well. Popovich's system just works no matter who you plug in there if those guys have bought in, and they've all bought in. So it's a very, very, very difficult team to contend with. I wonder if they will begin to wear down in the playoffs. Will Popovich be willing to play his bench as much? Will he turn to his starters more? If he does, do they start to wear down? I think you have to come up with scenarios like that in order to imagine the vulnerability of the Spurs, given how good they've been, especially lately. Now, having said that, this is the same team that two seasons ago was on a 20-game winning streak when they then lost four in a row to the Thunder. So there's a precedent for them looking unbeatable, for them looking like a team that no one was going to be able to touch. And then once you figure it out, once you find the key, you can beat them. But I don't think that it's a psychological or, you know, other disadvantage that the Clippers have against the Spurs. I think the Spurs are just that good. They are deep. They are incredibly well coached. They will never beat themselves. They move the ball and get better shots than any other team in the NBA. And they've got great players who are capable of making those shots. They're a very, very, very good team.
Throughout the regular season, the Clippers have never lost more than two games in a row. If they experience a three-game losing streak, it would have mean the Clippers will be eliminated in the playoffs. There have been cases in past seasons where teams who have long losing streaks are more likely to falter in the playoffs than those teams who lose two or less. How has the professionalism of the Clippers been like this season? What have they done in order to avoid such long losing streaks?
Well, I think that you have to give a ton of credit to Doc Rivers once again on that. He hasn't allowed the team to get into a bad groove at any point in the season. Every team seems to go through points where they're just not playing well. And this team has managed to avoid that. And when you consider the fact that J.J. Redick has been hurt the majority of the season, Chris Paul missed 20 games, Jamal Crawford has been hurt recently, they've dealt with significant injuries to key players, and they still have not fallen into a bad losing streak at any point in the season. That's Rivers making sure that their head is in the right place, that they are focused, that they are ready to play when they go out there on the court. They haven't gotten into any really bad habits. They haven't gotten down on themselves. And I think if you were to ask Doc about what he felt like needed to change from last season's team to this season's team, he recognized the talent level of this squad. That's why he wanted to be in Los Angeles coaching this team. He knew how good these guys were and could be. But he also would say that he saw them get down on themselves, get down on each other, get into each other's faces and complain and worry about things from time to time in the last two seasons. And that was something that he definitely wanted to change. And I think we can safely say that he has changed it. Even after losing two in a row, and in some cases, those were two games those were two tough opponents that they lost to. Those were two tough games, and it wasn't surprising that you lost those games. Or maybe it was two games that they did lose a game that they shouldn't have. They come back, they win the next one, they don't get down on themselves, they don't get down on each other, they come out and they do their jobs. And I think that that's a testament to Doc's influence on this team.
Finally, what do you think would be the ideal playoff path for the Clippers to take to improve their competitive psyche?
What route would they take? I think that they'd be happy to see Dallas in the first round, the last game notwithstanding. I think that they feel like they can beat Dallas. I think that the second round is almost certainly going to be Oklahoma City, and the third round is probably going to be the Spurs. So there's no easy routes through the Western Conference, quite clearly. This is a very, very deep and very talented conference. And the Clippers could end up seeing Memphis followed by Oklahoma City followed by the Spurs, which would be an absolute murderer's row to have to go through just for the right to meet Miami in the finals potentially. So there's just no easy way through the playoffs this season. And the bottom line is they're going to have to beat some good teams if they want to advance as far as they think they can.
And Golden State for what they did for getting Blake Griffin ejected, in addition for righting their 2012-13 season mishap.
Yeah, Golden State is not a team they want to see either. Houston is a tough team. I mean, even though they swept Houston, the Rockets are incredibly talented also. This is a very, very, very deep Western Conference.
Tell them where they can check you out on the web.
I am Steve Perrin. I'm the managing editor of ClipsNation.com. It is the best place on the web for Clippers news and information, so come on by.
Chris Wild and Mike Jaglin are there too. Steve Perrin of Clips Nation, everybody. There's more Clipper Talk to come on
Miami Radio.
When my father screams and shouts, "Dear Dad, I'm sad you're dead." A new man standing in the pulpit. He bows before a wooden cross and forces praise the culprit. I'm a tenor in the choir, but I sing a different song of how the where's and why's of now. I'll prove I don't belong, but I'm staying. I've planted seeds and plan to watch them grow. I've watered all my wishes, dreams fulfilled, more seeds to sow. And I promise to learn to love the way I learned to fear. to unknot all the inhibitions tangled in my hair, to let my ego mound in piles around the barber chair, and make a graceful exit from my vexed and troubled years. I've decided I've been invited to my own resort, where knights can leave their armor neatly piled by the door, and every woman, child, and man will gather by the shore and study how sea lions swim in cursive.
Force of my love was strong, a sea lion laying down long. A song in the air, why should singer care when singer can be among song?
The Clippers podcast continues tomorrow with Basketball Insider's beat writer Eric Pincus. The topic of interest?
Money, 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 money.